Thomas Frank is a famous author. He wrote What's the Matter with Kansas, a book that asks the question about why people struggling economically vote, quote-unquote, against their own interests, which is basically the framework liberals use for talking about why blue-collar conservatives, particularly in the Midwest, vote the way they do. Frank's journey researching that topic began with a trip to the library at KU, where he discovered a whole row of volumes of one single book. Same author, same title.
It was The Populist Revolt. It was a book published in 1931 by a guy called John Hicks. Once upon a time, a famous history of populism. So I pulled one down and started reading it. And lo and behold, it's about Kansas. It's about stuff that happened here. And I had never heard of any of it before.
He says that's when a light went on in his head. The conservatism Kansas was becoming known for was the progressive populism he was reading about, only turned upside down. And that realization stuck with him until years later he was living in Chicago reading about a new debate in his home state, a debate about teaching evolution in schools.
And I could not believe it, because that's not the state I grew up in.
He came to the conclusion that politicians had sold ordinary Kansans a bill of goods, with empty promises to turn back the clock on the cultural and economic changes that were rocking their world.
And that's where populism comes in, and the kind of reverse, the culture war right-wing populism that is everywhere around us today. But Kansas was, in some ways, was way ahead of the rest of America in this regard.
Well, it's been 15 years since that book came out, and now populism is a total buzzword, not just for Kansas politics, but American politics. Actually, European politics, too.
Populism is on the rise.
That populist message struck a chord with many voters.
Economic populism is the best approach to connect with voters.
Okay, but what is populism? On this day when populist Bernie Sanders has announced his candidacy for president, joining populist Elizabeth Warren running against populist Donald Trump, we are asking what this idea is all about and what it might mean in our area especially. It's KCUR's Central Standard. I'm Brian Ellison, in for Gina Kaufman, and here with me is Deborah Leitner. She's a political science professor at UMKC. Deborah, good morning.
Good morning.
And also with us from Washington, D.C. is Uri Friedman. He's a staff writer covering global affairs for The Atlantic. Hi, Uri.
Hi, good to be with you.
Glad you're both here. So, Deborah, start us off. Give us the most basic definition of populism.
Sure. Well, there is some debate, but the simplest definition of populism is the idea that there is the fundamental problem in politics is that the elites are different and separate from the people. Mm. And generally, populists then say that the only way to resolve the political ills of the day is to replace the existing elites with a new, more personally attuned group of people who will listen to the will of the people.
People who are really of the people.
Often.
Yeah, the way you put this, Uri Friedman, in your article in The Atlantic a couple of years ago is that populists are dividers, not uniters.
Yes, they really divide the world and their country into this. It's a very moral framework, actually, which is very interesting and not often the way politicians talk about politics. You have a corrupt elite that is thoroughly evil and is harming the people who are virtuous. The other thing that's interesting about populism that one expert, Casimuto, the way he put it to me, is that it's a thin ideology. So what he meant by that is that it calls for kicking out the establishment because they're corrupt, because they are not doing things in the best interest of the people, but it doesn't necessarily prescribe what that establishment should be replaced with. And so it's often paired with a thicker ideology, and it comes in very different forms, like socialism, nationalism, nativism, authoritarianism. You know, when we think about something like fascism as an ideology, that has a very specific thought process of how society should be ordered, how the economy should be ordered, how politics should be ordered. That's not the case with populism, and that's one of the reasons why it's so hard to define, because it comes in so many different forms. There's no such thing as like a specific populist policy. You can have left-wing populists, right-wing populists. They come in all different forms.
So as we're seeing now in American politics. Deborah Leitner, and I messed up your name when I first introduced you. It's Deborah Leitner from UMKC. How far back in history does this concept of populism go?
We can trace populism all the way back to the foundations of states. There's always been a sense, I think, in politics that those in power, especially those in democratic systems, might not be listening to the citizens that they're supposed to be listening to.
Okay.
So populist movements have always existed, but they're not always popular.
Populist does not mean the same thing as popular.
Popular, exactly right. So there's populist moments in history. We can really trace back to when sort of political frustration, economic frustration bubbles over, and then these populist movements really have a chance to gather a lot of support.
Give us an example of that. What's one of those key moments?
Other than right now, a famous moment in U.S. history was in the 19th century. Frustration by farmers led to the rise of a people's movement, most famously led by William Jennings Bryan, really representing this idea that the government was so representing business interests, generally through currency control, that they were no longer representing what citizens needed them to do.
And what was the outcome of that? How successful were the populists? Remind us.
They were exceptionally successful, especially here in the Midwest. In fact, in Kansas, there was a period where the governor was a populist. That was Lorenzo Llewellyn. Kansas sent the first populist to the Senate. That's William Pepper. And they were actually the largest party in the Kansas State House for a while. And that really lasted until 1893, when a fight between the populists and the Republicans got so heated that the populists locked themselves in the House and the Republicans broke down the door with a sledgehammer.
Wow. So this can take on more than just political implications. There's actually physical ramifications.
You can certainly really see the frustration that was rising by non-populists at the time.
Uri Friedman, when did the word populism start getting tossed around in this most recent iteration?
I think it's been bubbling up for some time. I mean, I think the moment where it really started circulating in the discourse was after Brexit, when Britain voted to leave the European Union. This was seen as a real moment in which populism wasn't just something that was in politics, you know, on the fringe, but went to the very center of politics. I mean, if you listen to what UKIP, the party that was advocating most for Brexit in that referendum, was saying after the referendum was successful, they were saying this is a victory for real people. That's a very populist thing to say, because what they were saying is, you know, the real people of the European of Britain want to leave the European Union, as if the 48% of people who did not vote to leave the European Union were somehow not real or less than real or not legitimate. And I think after that, the fact that that happened, and then shortly thereafter, a self-styled populist like Donald Trump won the election in the United States, that really made this take off. Because I think people said, wow, this is not, these people are moving to positions of power in some of the most powerful countries in the world. I think one cautionary tale I would say there is that we have to remember that, you know, had it not been for tens of thousands of votes in the United States, Hillary Clinton would have won, not Donald Trump. In Brexit, it was a very close vote. You know, half the public voted yes, half voted no. So we're talking a small margin, and I think of votes changing the entire way these kinds of elections would have been perceived. And I think we in the media, we as politicians in general, can get carried away by talking about populist waves when these things are actually you know, happening in very slim ways. And my feeling on it is that it's not necessarily some kind of populist wave, but populism is often like a canary in the coal mine for a crisis of democratic representation, for people saying, we don't know who to trust and we don't trust our center-left and center-right parties. And I think you're seeing that and a kind of fragmentation of politics where populists can take advantage of that rather than some kind of big monolithic populist wave.
So then, Deborah, what happens next when a 51% vote goes the populist direction and the center-right and center-left parties, they look at those results? Do they take a lesson from what has just happened? Do they change who they are? Or do things just sort of naturally cycle back, typically, as you look back through history?
It's kind of interesting in that different responses lead to really different outcomes. Populists are often quite challenged if they are successful, if they win in government.
Because now they aren't of the people. Now they're the ones in power.
Precisely. It's the populist claim that we need to replace the people in government and then things will solve themselves is a little bit of a simple solution. And often what populists find when they're in government is either they start to moderate and act like mainstream parties, or they're frustrated. They can't really do those things that they promised they would. And neither of these things tend to be very good for populist success.
Uri, that piece I mentioned a moment ago, you wrote for The Atlantic a couple of years ago, it was called What is a Populist and Is Donald Trump One? And that was back when his term was just getting started. Back then, what did you decide? Did you think he was a populist?
In many ways, yes, I think he fit the classic definition of a populist. And kind of, as I mentioned, you know, it's a thin ideology paired with a thicker ideology. I think his thicker ideology is nativism, nationalism, but with a big caveat, which is if you look at what Donald Trump was saying in the 1980s when he was about to run for president, he has been saying consistently for decades, the elite are even more than corrupt, they're fools. They are taking this country, you know, in the wrong direction. They don't know what they're doing. They don't know how to negotiate deals. So he's always been anti-establishment. I think that is a core conviction. But one thing that I was struck by in looking at his statements and his evolution in his rhetoric and the way he approaches issues over time is that I think he actually wasn't always a populist. And what happened is that people like Steve Bannon, who was, you know, his longtime advisor, no longer advising him but was in the White House, and Stephen Miller, a very influential speechwriter who is still in the White House, they kind of helped style him as a populist. And one thing I was really struck by is I went back to his announcement that he was running for president when he went down that escalator, went up that escalator, and, you know, that very moment that has become very iconic. In his announcement, he used some version of the word I 256 times. If you look at his when he was inaugurated as president after winning the election, he used the word I or some version of it 3 times. I think what changed over time as those advisors became more influential is they said, okay, you have like half the populist equation. You say kick out the establishment, but you need to style yourself as a vessel for the people. It's not about you. You are the leader of a movement. I think the genius of that was that it made people feel a part of something bigger than Donald Trump. They felt a part of a movement. You know, it's hard to say, oh, I identify with this billionaire real estate magnate who lives in like a penthouse in New York. But if I feel dissatisfied with the way, you know, our center left and center right parties are representing us, I feel my, you know, future isn't as bright as it was before. I have no trust in government institutions. This guy is saying he agrees with me completely. He's as angry as I am, and he is leading a movement. And I think that was when he became more of a self-styled populist. And I actually think, you know, even though Steve Bannon is no longer in the White House, I think in many ways he has stuck with that, even if it wasn't a core conviction for a long time. I think he still continues to style himself in many ways as a populist. You know,
do you think he's become more populist?
Potentially. I think he goes back and forth. You know, when he's in more unscripted remarks, he tends to be more of the old Donald Trump, where it's more about himself and about his own deal-making skills and less about representing the people. But I think in some ways, yes, in part because I think he has grown very frustrated with the checks and balances in government. You know, one mark of a populist, a lot of populists really believe in like elections and some parts of democracy. One thing they often struggle with is the more liberal form of democracy, not liberal like Democrats or left wing, but liberal in the form of like checks and balances on government, minority rights. And I think you've seen as he has grown more frustrated with the media, with the courts in the U.S., he has railed against those and sought to disempower those. And in some ways, that is very much a mark of populist. And I think that's become more so as he's tried to govern and run into frustration.
Which seems ironic to me, because you would think that a populist ideology, one that emphasizes the power of the people, would appreciate checks and balances and things that limit the power of one executive in charge, Deborah Leiter.
So this is always an interesting point, is that often what we see is that what populist emphasizes the will of the people, that this should be the dominant idea. Checks and balances would be an elite check on, populists would say, what the people want to do.
I see.
And so what's fascinating, what you see, is that amongst populist supporters, they tend to emphasize outcomes. Is the policy what I want it to be? I don't care as much how you got there. That's where people like Viktor Orban in Hungary have really been quite successful, Hugo Chavez in Venezuela. Let's not worry about the process. I'm going to do what you would do in office.
Well, we want to hear from you, our listeners. Do you think of yourself as a supporter of populist candidates and ideology? What does that mean to you? And where in our own region, in our own communities, our local states, have you seen evidence of the effects of populism? Give us a call at 816-235-2888. That's 235-2888. We'll be right back with answers to your questions and many more of mine on KCUR's Central Standard. So stay with us. It's KCUR Central Standard. I'm Brian Ellison, in for Gina Kaufman. We're talking today about populism in global politics and American politics, and right here in Kansas and Missouri. Deborah Leiter from UMKC is here. So is Uri Friedman from The Atlantic. And we want you to join our conversation at 816-235-2888 with your thoughts and questions. Deborah Leiter, what is it that was happening in our country that made a populist campaign like that of Donald Trump so appealing to voters?
Generally, populism does well when there's a sense of frustration by voters. And this frustration can come from a lot of places. Most people today point to sort of economic frustrations as one of those sources. The economy is on the rise. People worldwide are doing better than they have before. But, and this is a really important part, not everyone is doing equally well. Mm-hmm. And many people point to that disparity of economic outcomes as one of the central sources of frustration, particularly people in former industrial cities, cities that have been most hard hit by changes in economic performance, globalization, etc. That's been, I think, probably one of the primary reasons we're seeing so much frustration amongst voters.
And states like Michigan, Pennsylvania, Ohio, where Donald Trump's wins by, in some cases, not that many votes, were decisive.
Precisely, right? Those are places where we would expect populism to be appealing. People are frustrated there. They're not doing as well as they have in the past, as they believe they should, as others are doing.
I know both of you actually write about global affairs, and Uri Friedman, you've written about populism overseas a few times. Where else are we seeing politicians with populist messages right now?
In a lot of places. I mean, certainly in Europe. I know Deborah focuses on that as well. In Europe, there is a big wave of populism, not just in Britain, but in places like the Netherlands and Italy. And that's in part a result not just of economic malaise, because we know that there's been a European debt crisis and there's sluggishness. They're recovering, but it hasn't been as similar to our recovery in the United States. It hasn't been as great as people want, and they don't see their futures as bright as they used to. But also immigration. There was a big wave of immigration from Syria because of the Syrian civil war, and from Africa, coming over from Libya and other countries in northern Africa, and there was a big debate over how much countries should be open. Certainly in Germany, which took over a million asylum seekers, so that has been a big component. One other really interesting place to watch is Brazil, because Jair Bolsonaro was just elected president, and I think his election is both concerning because he talks a lot about the glory days of military rule, and Brazil is actually a rather young democracy, and he talks about changing the constitution in ways that could make it for a more liberal democracy. On the other hand, I think his election does illustrate that populism tends to sometimes is used in a negative way, but populism is a response to a real dissatisfaction among the public with the way elites have handled politics. And in Brazil, that is so evident because they just went through a gigantic corruption scandal that really tainted all parties, and there was no one to be trusted. I mean, public trust in institutions, we think it's low for Congress. It was like in the single digits, like 3%, 4%, 5% in Brazil, and he really responded to that. But there's a lot of knocks against him. He has never been implicated in a corruption scandal. So I think we can learn a lot from looking at where this is taking root overseas.
Let's bring our listeners into the conversation. You can join us with your questions for Uri Friedman or Deborah Leiter at 816-235-2888. Let's start with Jason in Kansas City. Hi, Jason.
Hi there. Can you hear me okay?
We can hear you. What's your question?
Terrific. My question is that every time, certainly in this last election cycle, but I think in almost every election cycle that we see, candidates are constantly saying things like Washington is broken or we want our government back, and across both parties. And I wonder if your terrific guest could comment about the idea that populism is sort of co-opted a little bit by almost every candidate in every election cycle. And I'll take my answer off the air. Thanks so much.
Appreciate it, Jason. That's a really interesting question. I mean, is there some degree that everyone has to be a little bit populist, Deborah, to get elected?
I always think it's funny that even incumbents run against Congress, right? And what I think this has done over the years as it's become more of a framework is that people start to believe you. If everyone is saying there's a problem with the government, even if they're in it, there's no reason people wouldn't. And so
which is why Congress always has an epically low approval rating.
Yeah, somewhere between 13% to 20% on average. So often worse than one survey showed less popular than Kim Kardashian.
Well,
so
that's
so
understandable.
Yeah, fair enough.
So, I mean, Uri Friedman, do you feel like there is a distinction to be drawn between this sort of casual populism that most politicians adopt and a more deeply embedded populism that marks just a few candidates we identify that way?
Yeah, I think it's a totally fair statement that there are everyone runs against Washington. Everyone tries to style themselves as an outsider, even if they've been in Congress for decades. So that is a feature of politics. And I think especially at a moment when populism is on the rise, people want to kind of, you know, leap on the bandwagon and use populist language. But I think there are subtle but really important, significant differences in how a dyed-in-the-wool populist talks about populism versus just any politician. You know, if things are framed in a moral dimension and a real, as I mentioned, monolithic dimension, that the elites are all corrupt, the people are virtuous, people who are critics of the populist leader are not legitimate. Any kind of criticism is based on an effort, you know, to being in cahoots with the elites as opposed to a way a pluralist democracy works. That is a difference that matters, and I think you can tell the difference between someone who is more thoroughly populist and one who's not based on that.
Deborah, a little while ago, you alluded to populism having some deep roots in Kansas, and we heard some of that from Thomas Frank early at the beginning of the program as well. Are you seeing evidence of that in present-day Kansas? Did we see it in some of the recent decades of deeply conflicted elections here?
I think both in Kansas and Missouri, we're seeing these potential populist appeals having some weight. To jump the border to Kansas, Eric Greitens, for example, wasn't
to Missouri.
To Missouri,
yes.
Sorry.
Yeah.
To Missouri. Part of the reason that Eric Greitens was successful was he absolutely appealed on a populist framework. I'm outside of the system. The system itself is broken. I'm going to come in and reform the system by replacing the elites. On the Kansas side, I think that was part of Sam Brownback's appeal just a few years ago. So populism is very successful today, but it's not brand new. The tide towards populism has been building for some time.
But it's interesting, in both of those examples, Uri Friedman, Sam Brownback was pretty much left office under a cloud. A Democrat was elected to succeed him. His populist ideologies didn't necessarily gain enough traction to keep him popular. Same thing with Eric Greitens, who, of course, had to resign last year. The system that he pledged to reform really did turn against him. He had very few friends of either party in office. Is that a normal consequence of being a quote-unquote successful populist candidate?
Yeah, I think that does happen a lot where, first of all, you make a lot of promises on the campaign trail that are, especially populists often do, that are pretty dramatic because they're trying to show a break with the establishment, right? And so when you don't deliver on those, if you moderate an office, you can lose popularity. Another thing that happens, I think, is less likely in a place like the United States, which has such a long democratic tradition. But something you do see is that in countries where there are weaker democratic institutions, when you lose popularity because you don't deliver on your promises, there's something that some experts I've spoken to talk about, like the post-populist dictatorial mode, which is that you basically, if you can't deliver, if you can't deliver the, you know, the highs to the public that you want to, then you try to concentrate power. And one place where I've seen this is Venezuela, which is very much in the news right now. You know, the Trump administration is taking a hardline policy against the current president, saying that he is no longer legitimate. They are supporting the head of the legislature, who they say is the legitimate president. And what the president often says is that this is because of the current president Maduro's socialist policies. You know, it's being described as a prime example, exhibit A, of the failures of socialism, which is an ideological argument. But I think populism also played a role there because Hugo Chavez, the predecessor, he for a while was very popular, but then, you know, he just wasn't able to deliver in his later stages. And certainly his successor, Nicolas Maduro, has had to deal with the fact that oil prices have plummeted. Venezuela is an oil-producing state. So how do you continue to stay in office? And he has turned to authoritarianism. So that is a risk in some countries.
When you paint a picture of idealism and you can't bring about the ideal, you become increasingly desperate or insistent about doing so.
Mm-hmm, exactly.
Let's take another call from David in Overland Park. Hello, David.
Yes, good morning. I love your topic. Well, you sort of approaching my question. My interest is Do populists always lead to violence and name calling and ostracizing and victim blaming? Does it always start off that way, or is that what happens at the end, like Maduro now?
That's an interesting question, David. Deborah Leiter, does populism always end up violent or intensely negative?
It doesn't have to, right? Populism, some of it depends on what populism is paired with. But it's worth keeping in mind that populism doesn't come out when there's no problems. Populists that come in and approach changing the political system or the economic system, that have substantive systemic plans, can, in fact, induce really important changes. However, when they come in as simply a negative ideology, we know what we don't want, that's when very frequently the victim blaming comes in. To take the example of Venezuela, Chavez was doing well, the economy collapsed, he needed a new enemy. And so he found a new enemy, and that tended to be external. And that's where the dangers of populism lie.
Uri, anything to add to that?
Yeah, I think in Venezuela you see a few. Again, I don't want to say like Venezuela collapsed because of populism. I think that's a simplistic explanation, but I do think you see certain ways that populism can go sour and can contribute to a real problems in a country. One way, yeah, and it doesn't always have to be this way. I don't think it always ends in violence or collapse of state institutions. But one way in Venezuela you see it is short term thinking. So populists want to deliver quickly on their campaign messages, and so for Chavez, for example, I mean they have one of the most biggest proven oil reserves in the world. But instead of a country like, there's countries like Norway, which, you know, have elements of socialism in their practices. They have a rainy day fund, basically. They have a sovereign wealth fund where they put oil revenues into. Chavez never did that. He always wanted to deliver right away to the people. And so he was always thinking short term, and they were running budget deficits and plowing money into social programs. Another way is railing against, you know, if you don't see your opposition as legitimate because you are representing the people fully, you are the only one representing the people, you rail against anyone who is thwarting the people's will. And so what you saw with Chavez is they eliminated independent media, they packed the courts, you know, the central bank stopped being independent. So you see the ways in which gradually democratic backsliding can happen. And thirdly, in Venezuela, one thing I think is important that I've come across in looking into populism is that it's not something that happens overnight where society changes. It's gradual. It's little by little. These are not like authoritarians, dictators who take over. They just rail against certain aspects of liberal democracy and try to weaken those. And I think what you see in Venezuela, listen, Chavez came to power in the late 90s. Only now are we seeing some of the things that his policies and ways of governing have wrought. So it takes time. And I think you're seeing that in Venezuela.
Let's take another call from Murad in Independence. Hello, Murad.
Good morning. Very interesting topic. One thing I've noticed in my observation, because I pay attention to the news, is that most of the populism, especially across the water in Europe, is that this populism is based upon a notion of nationalism. They're not wanting people who look like them or speak like them to be a part of their country anymore. They're taking their resources. And to move to another statement that your guest just made, populism is something as a result of politics, how politics has changed or economics has changed. In our own country, that very same thing happened through the first 8 years of Obama. Henceforth, the people who supported Trump the most were the people who were against Obama being president.
So you're saying that
Trump himself.
There's sort of a system of winners and losers that is just a natural consequence of politics, and populism is sort of just another way of organizing the electorate into teams, as it were.
No, I wouldn't say that, because very good things were done in the 8 years, but you had people like Donald Trump who continued to do everything he could to make it difficult for an elected president, Barack Obama.
Okay.
And now, of course, he's the president. And the people who support him most, you've seen the rallies before.
Sure.
They're not people of color at those rallies. I don't care what color, whether they're African-American, Hispanic, Asian. Those people are not there.
Okay.
And what he did...
I want to give our guests a chance to respond, Murad, and I appreciate what you're
saying.
Go ahead.
Absolutely.
Deborah Leiter.
Well, I think one of the questions, or one of the most common ways you hear about populism today, is right-wing populism, far-right populism. And the question is why. And one of the answers is that it's not particularly hard to go from the will of the people to the will of my people, mm-hmm. to the will that idea that a country, particularly, this is particularly common in Europe, is made up of a certain nationality. And that populism tied to far-right nationalism says we should be protecting our people. And the easiest way to find that, once again, populists identify than us versus them, is to point to outsiders, foreigners, immigrants, elites that are bringing about these social changes that are not wanted by this nationalistic idea. So that's where I think some of that comes from, those two ideas have been going hand in hand.
But that does make it seem like populism on the left, so thinking of the very fervent support that Bernie Sanders gained 2 years ago in the presidential race 3 years ago, and the kind of populist support that Elizabeth Warren sometimes is said to have, that, Uri Friedman, that seems like it's a very different breed of populism.
Yes, it is. And one thing that studies have found is that when populism manifests itself on the left, it's often the populace saying, I'm going to defend the lower and middle classes against the upper class, which is, you know, taking all the wealth away, things like that. You know, Bernie Sanders, in announcing his candidacy this week, talked about the greed of the upper classes. But right-wing populism, as Deborah mentioned, it often manifests itself more as the populace saying, I am crusading against the elites because the elites are supporting or not being hard enough line against a third group, which is outsiders often. So often the anti-immigrant or immigration restrictionist tendencies of populism, the nativism, the nationalism, tends to be part of right-wing populism, not left-wing populism.
But so let me read you this email from Andrew who wrote in. He says, I disagree with your guest's contention that populism is different in that it attempts to create an us versus them mentality. One of the major reasons Trump won was the clear contempt that Clinton and Obama expressed for conservatives, for example, clinging to their guns and their Bibles, calling them deplorables, etc. Showing the differences in beliefs is the whole point of elections, Andrew says in an email. I mean, nobody would call Obama or Hillary Clinton populists, at least I don't think most people would. Is it really so different, Deborah Leiter?
Great question. And I think the important point is the distinction we would draw between mainstream sort of politics and populists is that mainstream says the difference between us is based on what we think government should do. Right? Now, certainly when there's polarization, we can move that difference in opinions to difference in kind and people. Populists don't draw that distinction. It's not an ideological difference. It's saying that the people in power, whomever they be, mm-hmm. are inherently corrupt, different, and not listening to people. And I think that's an important distinction, is drawing the lines based on what you think government should do versus who is in government.
Uri Friedman, as you think about American politics today, if we're to learn from history, if we're to learn from the experiences of the rest of the world, where do you see this going?
Well, I think one thing to point out is we should – I think you can – as I mentioned before, you can use the term populist to tar and feather people, your opponents. I think we should really think about why populism on both the left and the right has become popular here and what that says about the crisis of democratic representation, the crisis of our center-left and center-right parties, income distribution. We should think about the reasons why this is popular, not just criticizing opponents and calling them populist. I also think, though, that – as we look comparatively, populism has a tendency to erode liberal democratic institutions, things like civil liberties, civil rights, checks and balances of power. We should be vigilant about that. And one other thing I'd point out is that I do think in many ways Donald Trump fits the mold of a populist. And one thing to keep in mind is while we can learn something from around the world, we can't learn everything, because actually a populist has not really come to power in a country like the United States with as long of a democratic tradition as it has, and also with a presidential system. A lot of these populists, especially in Europe, are in parliamentary systems where the distribution of power is very different. So in some ways we can learn from other countries, but actually it's almost even sometimes even more striking and revelatory to think about how we don't really have a precedent for a populist
territory.
Yeah, leading a country like the United States.
That's Uri Friedman. He's a staff writer covering global affairs for The Atlantic. We've also been joined by Deborah Leiter. She's a political science professor here at UMKC. Thanks to both of you for joining us today.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
When we come back, we'll turn to music. He plays in Kansas City jazz clubs, he collaborates with famous artists, and now he's got a new group doing an entirely new thing. Eddie Moore will tell us about that when Central Standard continues in just a minute. Welcome back. It's KCUR Central Standard. I'm Brian Ellison, in for Gina Kaufman. Eddie Moore is a local pianist who has collaborated with some huge names in music, Boyz II Men, Erykah Badu, Mos Def, the Marcus Lewis Big Band. He plays in jazz clubs across the city, and his new group, We the People, will play at the American Jazz Museum this weekend. But calling his music jazz might not tell the whole story, as he's going to tell us. Eddie Moore, welcome to Central Standard.
How you doing, Brian? Thanks for having me.
It's really great to have you here. So how would you describe the music you write and perform? You call it jazz, right?
I do. I call it jazz. I guess it fits into that genre. I just call it music, really.
Yeah? You know? What's it like? How do you describe it to people if they've never heard it?
My music is like rolling down a hill on a bike with no brakes. And you just have to weave through everything that gets in your way or jump over it.
Do you think that's kind of is that a definition of jazz as far as you're concerned?
No. I mean, that's a long story, though, if we get into the definition of jazz. I guess my definition of jazz, which is informed by the masters and Duke Ellington and, you know, all the greats, it's just the music of the freedom of expression. Mm-hmm. It's the American idiom. It's like both of all cultures coming together to create something new.
Well, it takes back to the beginning for you, musically. You grew up in Houston. When did you start playing the piano?
I started playing the piano at the age of 4. My mom started me in private lessons.
And what kind of music were you playing?
I started off classical, like I guess how most students do, you know, mm-hmm. privately. Mm-hmm. The piano was a one-man instrument for me.
and do you remember loving it from the start, or were you like any other kid? Did your mom have to beg you to practice?
Yeah, I come from a musician family, and my mom had to fight with me, honestly. Yeah. I didn't really like it until about I was like 18 or so.
Wow, and what changed at 18?
I just got hip to some more music. I was like spending tons of time at the skate park and listening to a lot of different hip hop and like Tribe Called Quest and jazz influenced hip hop. And so as a classical pianist, I didn't know how to play that music and wanted to learn. I'd been listening to jazz through my dad like my entire life. And so then when I got to college, I started the journey.
So that journey eventually took you to Kansas City. How come? Why did you end up in Kansas City?
I wanted to go to grad school or just play more jazz music. There wasn't a lot in Houston at the time. And so I moved here in about 2010 and, of course, attended UMKC.
The conservatory.
And then just got on the scene and playing with a lot of young jazz musicians and then a lot of like older veteran jazz musicians who really like taught me how the music went and, you know, the culture of it.
You eventually and recently have formed a new band called We the People. Tell us about it.
We the People is a new project. It's basically piano trio with an electronic element. So you're talking about piano, keys, drums, and bass. There's more of an electronic element, say, than the Outer Circle. On the album, you'll hear, like, our producer is a DJ. So he's a member of the band. Mm-hmm. Shout out to Lenny Destroy. And the music is, I mean, it's more has more of my influences, a little more of the rock element, a little bit more of the hip-hop. It's a lot more intimate because I'm the front instrument as a pianist. And so I'm doing a lot of different things and a lot of different textures than just piano. So I'm playing Fender Rhodes, I'm playing synthesizer and key bass and looping some things. And so.
And there's a producer, a DJ.
And there's a DJ.
And what other instruments?
Keyboard and bass and drums.
Okay. So it's in some ways feels like a traditional jazz trio, and in some ways not at all traditional.
Yeah.
Well, let's actually listen to some of the music. We're going to hear something from how you introduced your winter concert last month. So there's a little bit from that concert. Let's listen to just a little bit of that.
Hello, my name is Duke Ellington.
Yeah, my name is Duke Ellington.
What about the future?
What are we listening to?
Okay, that's a good question. Basically, you're listening to jazz on jazz. And so what I did is, with the sampler, I took clips from a Duke Ellington interview where he's talking about the roots of jazz music and the future of music from 1963. And then I chopped it up a lot how a DJ would in a hip-hop environment. And then instead of using jazz information to put over another genre of music, I'm playing a standard under that. It's Along Came Betty by Benny Golson. So you're hearing me play traditional jazz music solo piano, but then you're also hearing what a master of the culture has to say about the music and the future of the music. I think when he talks about the future, he's actually talking about now. You know, it's 2019. He was saying that in 1963. Yeah. And so you're hearing the recreation of the story that I chopped up.
What are you hoping your listeners are feeling and experiencing while they're hearing that compilation of words and piano and story?
I'm hoping that it opens their minds to what the music really is, and it brings them to listen to more new jazz music or more improvised music. There's a big stigma on what our music is and what it's not, and everyone has their thing to say. So that's kind of my answer to that. Instead of talking about it, you can hear it from him and see what you say. Who's Duke Ellington? You know, the ambassador of jazz music. And so you get to hear it from him by way of that. And like I said, I come from a hip hop culture as well. So it totally fits in the realm to chop and sample people, and especially jazz music. That's like a long thing in hip hop.
Do you think there's a big barrier, or that there has been one, between hip hop culture and jazz culture?
No, actually, I think hip hop culture and jazz culture are very connected. And everyone that's in hip hop culture sees that. I think it's everyone else around us that looks into the jazz lane that sees that there's a difference, but they're very much one and the same. They're two urban art forms, or art forms created through an urban environment in America, that are built on improvisation and life experience. I think the one thing about hip hop that is very different than jazz is that they don't have criticism on what is and what isn't rap or hip hop.
Yeah.
They just go with the flow and let it be.
Do you find yourself ever having to sort of, I don't know, defend what you are doing as authentically part of the tradition?
Oh, all the time, every day of my life. Like, every day of my life, I'm defending our freedom of expression, which is crazy to me because this is essentially rebel music. It started off that way. And so it's wild because I'm not paving a lane. There's several lanes for what I'm doing already paved by, like, Robert Glasper and Chick Corea and Herbie Hancock and...
And you think this is very much in line with those, with that tradition?
Oh, definitely. Yeah. Very much. Like I said, I'm still, with that first clip, I'm still playing jazz solo piano.
Yeah. I mean, that's the most dominant sound. I mean, everyone right. can hear that in what's happening there.
Right, right.
Well, let's listen to one more clip. This is from the band We the People that is playing at the American Jazz Museum this weekend. And we're going to hear a little of the group's single Bando. Let's start that, and then I want to ask you about it. Now, right here, this sounds like, I think, what anyone would say, sort of traditional sounding jazz, right?
Right.
And what are we listening to? Why? What is this?
It's basically a song I wrote for my cousin. And this part of it, the instrumental, you know, you hear the church vibe. Mm-hmm. It's got, you know, getting into the music, it's got a lot of church.
Kind of the harmony. The Hammond organ sound.
Right,
sort
the
of,
Hammond yeah. and the Rhodes. The melody and the harmony is, like, in the color of minor pentatonic, so it's soulful.
Uh-huh.
And then it goes into this part where it transitions. So you almost hear him transitioning. Mm-hmm. And then it goes into, I'm not going to ruin it, but it goes into another, you know.
Well, I think we're starting to hear the music changing here. Let's see how this transition plays out. Well, now that stopped sounding like church at some point.
Right.
What is this transition? What's happening now?
It's transition to you know, you're hearing like the influence of hip hop. Shout out to Duncan Burnett from Olathe, and you're hearing just, you know, him saying about being a great person, being a great man. You know, humility to be the man for the people. In the chorus, he talks about, you know, it's a song that talks about growing up in urban culture as an African American and all the challenges that are out to kind of stop you from succeeding. You know, and he's talking, you know, he says in the chorus, instead of my fist, I'll use my voice. We're going to fight till we change something, you know, and he's like talking about seeing people die around him. A lot of them look like me. I don't know how I'm going to survive, but I got to keep going forward, you know.
Yeah. You're now doing some teaching, right?
Yeah.
Who are you teaching?
I'm teaching a lot of young kids. I teach out in Olathe at the Culture House.
Okay.
It's a great time. I'm there like maybe 3 days a week.
And are you teaching them jazz? Are you teaching them standards? Or are you teaching them something different?
We just talk about music. You know, we talk about everything music, whatever they want to know. All of them are working on very different things. I have one student who's maybe like 10 or 11 who wants to learn Piano Man. Huh. So we're learning Piano Man from the record by ear. He just like caught the solo yesterday.
Wow.
And so it's pretty incredible. Some of, you know, all from the age of 6 to probably like 17. I have some adult students, but everyone's working on different things. There's less jazz students than just music students. Mm-hmm. I love music and I listen to all different types of music and teach all different types of music. It's all fun to me.
In these 6 to 17 year old kids that you're teaching, do you see some of the 6 to 17 year old Eddie Jones who didn't yet really have this love of jazz or expand his thinking beyond classical until later?
Yeah, I have some of them. Most of the students that come to me actually want to learn, like, American music, you know, everything outside of classical. I always focus on technique, so we work on classical technique for at least 15 minutes of it. Mm-hmm. But then it's really addressing what they want to know. Some of the times we're listening to music because that's a big part of it. You know, that some of them that want to learn jazz have never heard jazz, so it's like, okay, well, let's listen to a record, and I can explain to you what you should be listening to or what's going on. That's part of it, how to listen to the music.
You've got this this concert this weekend at the Blue Room at the American Jazz Museum. That's Friday at 8:30. I know tickets are $10. What can people expect if they show up?
You can expect a great time. We're just going to have fun and groove. We have a lot of different things. You'll see like a lot of different textures from myself and the band. I have DeAndre Manning with me on bass and Zach Morrow on drums. And so we're just going to have fun and groove, play some songs you don't know and play some songs you have heard before, but maybe never like that.
You know, you don't seem like a guy who has a lot of spare time on his hands, but what's next for you? Is We the People your main thing for a while?
We the People is definitely my main thing. We're in the studio working on an album right now. I can't give you the date on that, but we're just taking our time and getting everything right. Doing a little bit of traveling to my home city, Houston, in April. I think we're going to hit Detroit again in July, and just focused on what's coming next year. You know, for us, it's like planning way, way out. Mm-hmm. But you'll definitely be hearing a lot of new music from us and just getting on the road, sharing Kansas City music.
Well, it's pretty great music, and I'm excited to see what's next. And I hope folks will go out to the Blue Room at the American Jazz Museum on Friday night at 8:30. Eddie Moore, thank you so much for taking a few minutes with us today.
Thanks for having me.
It's really a pleasure. We also spoke today with Deborah Leiter of UMKC and Uri Friedman of The Atlantic Magazine about the concept of populism in today's politics. You can check out both of these conversations again at kcur.org/centralstandard later today. That's kcur.org/centralstandard. You can also contact us on Twitter. We're at KCURCST and I'm at PTS Brian. Tomorrow, we'll hear about Black cultural institutions in Kansas City as places of community healing. Also, a documentary that tells the story of 12th Street. That's tomorrow at 10 on Central Standard. Central Standard's produced by Melody Rowell with Coy Duggar, Chris Young, Suzanne Hogan, and intern Salisa Kalakal. Sylvia Maria Gross is our senior producer. I'm Brian Ellison, in for Gina Kaufman. Up to Date is next, so stick around.